observed all the.
So move on then to our Ten Commandments, and let's start with a little quiz. The first commandment is, I'm the Lord your God, no other God before me. He's number one. Number two, no graven images, no idols. Number three, don't take the Lord's name in vain. Don't speak. There's the three. What's number four? Honor the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Number five, honor your father and mother. Number six, don't join ISIS. You shall not kill. Shall not murder. Number seven, don't commit adultery. What's the picture?
Broken heart.
Number eight, shall not steal. Number nine, bear false witness or lie. Number ten, you shall not covet. So we're going to talk about coveting. Again, we haven't gone far enough to prepare our questions, so I'm using Spurgeon, which is basically what we've been following. What's the tenth commandment? And again, he's basically selecting out, sometimes mildly editing, the Westminster Shorter Catechism. What's the tenth commandment? The tenth commandment is, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, or his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. That's just quoting Exodus 20. What's forbidden in the 10th commandment? The 10th commandment forbids all discontentment with our own estate, envying or grieving at the good of our neighbor, and all inordinate emotions and affections to anything that is his. We'll develop those thoughts. The Westminster Shorter Catechism. So the Bible says you shall not. And so the question is, what's forbidden? But again, the Catechism also asks the question, well, if that's forbidden, then what's required? The 10th commandment requires full contentment with our own condition, with a right and charitable frame of spirit toward our neighbor and all that is his. So Spurgeon just went with what is it and what's forbidden, and that's primarily what we'll look at. Discontent. What is forbidden? So we're going to go through those three elements. There's three things they said are forbidden. The 10th commandment forbids all discontentment with our own estate or what we have. And 1 Corinthians 10:10 says, talks about Israel, and the believers are told, do not complain as some of Israel complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. And so they were discontent with God's provision. They complained and they died. That's a good verse to teach in Sunday school. You know, you complain, it's over. Hebrews 13:5. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. So the opposite of covetousness is not being content. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. What does that have to do with contentment? Pardon me? God is enough. Yeah, that is the ultimate answer. Contentment is not if I could just make a little bit more. I read this account of some young man who was really wrestling with the issues of contentment and covetousness even. And a wise older man took him aside and said, so how much is enough? And he said, well, I don't know, 2,000, 10,000 pounds, whatever it was at the time. And he gave a bunch of numbers. And the man kept saying, no, no, no. Well, how much is enough? He said, always a little more. Just a little more. Problem is, it's just like that restaurant, free crab tomorrow. You know? So it's always a little more, which means there's never enough. You know, someone said, man, if I could make $100 a month, I will be just fabulously wealthy. Next thing you know, if I could make $1,000, and then you look at some of these gazillionaires, and they're still trying to figure out how to make more money. So here's the point. There's never, if your contentment is on reaching a certain financial goal, you're going to find that doesn't work. Well, let's look at this. So speaking about contentment reminds me of Thomas Watson and Jeremiah Burroughs speaking about contentment in their books. Thomas Watson said this, in the art of divine contentment. Now, let's be honest. Go think about the last time you were in a bookstore or even browsing Amazon or one of those. How popular do you think the art of divine contentment would ring out as a title today? You know, it's not contentment. You got to, you know, anything but. That doesn't sound so exciting. Well, here's what he says. Murmuring, that's the opposite of contentment, right? Complaining. Murmuring is no better than mutiny in the heart. What's mutiny? Rebellion. Rebellion at sea in particular. Murmuring, complaining is rebellion. It is a rising up against God. When the sea is rough and unquiet, it casts forth nothing but foam. When the heart is discontented, it casts forth the foam of anger, impatience, and sometimes little better than blasphemy. Murmuring is nothing else but the scum which boils off from a discontented heart. Have you ever cooked a meat, chicken meat or something, and you've got it in there boiling or something, cook whatever you do, what do you want? It's in hot water. I don't know if it's boiling, simmering. And they take a spoon, and you take a spoon, you kind of skim off the... That's what murmuring is. It's scum. Again, parents, you might try that next time you hear some murmuring. That's nothing but a mutinous, treacherous scum. So the strong words about the problem, discontent, is fundamentally complaining against God. And that's why God destroyed the Israelites, because it was an act of unbelief and non-submission to God's ways. And Paul reminds New Testament believers of that and says, look at Israel, learn a lesson. Discontent with God's provision is mutiny. Oh, yeah. It's all built on you need more, don't you? It's all about making people discontent. And so, yeah. Here's a Jeremiah Burroughs, the rare jewel of Christian contentment. In other words, you don't see this all over the place. I offer the following description. Christian contentment is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. Notice the contrast. One is the frothing up of if you will, scum in a storm, and the other is sweet and gracious. So this is really speaking to heart issues, isn't it? What is the condition of our heart? So one thing he talks about is contentment, and and discontent is a sin. Contentment is required. What is forbidden in the 10th commandment? The 10th commandment forbids envying or grieving at the good of our neighbor. So covetousness is what? I want something. Envy is... Yeah, you have what I want, and you shouldn't have it. That's envy. How come I've got this little popsicle, and I've already half eaten, it's going away, and it's melting? She's got that big, beautiful ice cream cone. And it's so coveting is, I want that ice cream cone. Envy is, I resent that you have a better ice cream, better treat than I do. So what's forbidden? Back to that question, the 10th commandment, forbids all inordinate emotions and affections to anything that is his. So we're going to talk about more of that covetousness, but and the emphasis on that. But first thing I want us to note, too, that it's a envy and a whole spirit here is discontent with what God has. Envying is the spirit of, and I'm resentful that you have more than I do. So if covetousness is what drives our advertising today, envy drives politics, doesn't it? Isn't that a huge element of today's politics? It's not right that those people have more than us, whatever that is. Envy is, why does that guy have a better opportunity than I do? That's a spirit of our age, envy and covetousness. So what's forbidden in the 10th commandment? The 10th commandment forbids all inordinate emotions and affections to anything that is the neighbor's. Colossians 3, 5. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. And notice in Ephesians, Paul also said, the covetous man will not enter into heaven, and he's an idolater. Covetousness is idolatry. So to covet is to, first of all, the word means basically to desire. Have you ever had someone express, I covet your prayers? Have you ever heard that expression? Well, that isn't necessarily a sinful desire, sinful statement. I'm coveting here, and I'm an idolater. But it's rather, it's an expression of desire. The basic word in the Hebrew here is to desire. But it can be a wrongful desire. And so, first, positively, it's to desire, to delight in something pleasant. Negatively, it's that inordinate, ungoverned, selfish desire. And here I'm just quoting what a Hebrew lexicon says. It's out of balance. It's ungoverned. It's that frothing sea. And it's selfish. That's fundamental to it. Covetousness isn't saying, I would really appreciate your prayer. I would really enjoy this. Covetousness is selfish and discontent. And especially, I want what you have. Have you ever tried to not to covet when you're at the mall? One lady asks her friend, it gave me an anxiety attack trying not to covet at the mall. Isn't the mall trying to make you desire things you don't have and wish you had what so-and-so had? So covet versus envy. Covet is wanting what someone else has. Envy is resenting that someone else has it. See the difference? Coveting, I want what you have. Envy is, it's not fair that you have something I don't have. Why is your house bigger? Why is it you have a nicer car? Why is it your car runs? That's envy. I resent that you have what I want. Covetousness is, I want what you have. I don't want you to have it. I'm not delighting in you having it. I'm not rejoicing with those who rejoice. I resent your good fortune. That can come up about someone's car, someone's house, someone's boat. How about someone's job or someone's promotion? It's not right that you got that promotion. I'm much smarter than you are. Or whatever it may be. I have more seniority. So, desire is forbidden. Not simply, here's what defines the unforbidden desire. Not simply finding your neighbor's possession desirable. That's a nice car, house, job you've got, but I'd like to have one like that someday. Rather, it's, I want your house. I want your car. I want your wife. That's when it is sinful desire, as opposed to just, hey, I appreciate that. That's something really nice. Maybe I'll work hard and get one of those one day. So here's a guy seeking pastoral counsel. And the pastor's response is, it's a tricky theological point. You say you covet your neighbor's humility. I'm not sure how to counsel you on that one. Humility is good, but coveting's bad. So the badness is, I want your stuff. And again, that's a growing trend. You know, we hear, for example, redistribution of wealth. I want to take what you have and give it to myself. So here's a problem. This sin was Paul's problem. Romans 7, he said this, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. When the commandment came, sin revived, I died. Now, he's not saying he didn't know the commandment. He could have quoted it in Greek, in Hebrew, probably in Latin. He knew the word. He knew the concept. But the law in forbidding it spoke to his heart. And here's the challenge. He was a good Pharisee, remember? He was one of the premier Pharisees. He walked down the street. He walked the aisle in the synagogue. And people would talk and whisper. He is such a holy man. But that he could do that all externally. He could look at the other commandments and say, I've done those things. But covetousness spoke and said, but how's your heart? And that's what's very important. A lot of people take the law and externalize it. We're learning in Sunday school, Jesus talked about the fact the law really speaks to heart issues. Thou shalt not covet, convicted Paul. What did he covet? Some of the thoughts that might come to my mind is maybe he was coveting other people's position or prestige. I saw a lot of this in the academic world, especially on the secular campus. There was such a pride and coveting. I want the glory. I remember one professor, he would go on and on about how he footnoted an idea 2 years before someone else published on it. I had the idea first. I want the pride. I want the glory. And a lot of times they're coveting. Who gets the greater position? Again, that can be true in the business world. I want the bigger title. I want the better office. Apparently, in America, you want the corner office with lots of glass. In Japan, if they give you a corner office with big windows, that is a slight. Apparently, you're so worthless, we're just going to put you someplace where you can look out the window. The real workers are inside. But here's the point. Prestige. I want position. I want prestige. I want power. That's what he wanted. And like I said, in the academic world, who published the best? Who got the greatest honors? I read about a seminary professor who craved the approval, especially of the secular academics. And he put out this work that was going to be his greatest work of all, and it was panned. I mean, they just said, this thing's, the professor he most honored rejected it, was scathing in his review. That professor's life just basically turned upside down. Became an alcoholic, became useless, wandered around the campus, not a campus, but all that to say, academics. By the way, common in religion, and I'm thinking here churches, or could have been in synagogues too, wanting to be the most famous. And so you'll see some in the church realm where people are constantly wanting the more prestigious church, the more famous pulpit. When one of the great orators or preachers of the day retires or dies, and there's 100 young men that feel that they're the ones that should be in that position. I remember hearing about a seminary student who was studying in his office or his home one day, and he was deep in his studies, and he was working on a sermon for one of his preaching classes, and he looked up to his wife and said, honey, how many truly great preachers do you think there are? And she said, probably one less than you think. Where people are looking after prestige and honor and praise. I'm saying all these things because, what was it that Paul coveted? I think that's it. He wanted the glory. You know, because notice how over in Philippians he can crank out his credentials. Here's my birth credentials. Here's my training credentials. I studied under Gamaliel. I mean, I had the best. And how often he must have taken comfort that by the end of chapter 3, he says, but all that stuff I threw on the rubbish bin so that I could know Christ. But that thou shalt not covet pierced his heart because he knew he did. He wasn't content. And so that's covetousness. So we already read, too, that in Colossians and Ephesians, it says that covetousness is really idolatry. Idolatry in what sense? Here's some things to covet. You can see, of course, the one on the left on the top. What's that represent? Money, riches. That's a big thing we covet often. What do you think on the right it represents? Stuff, yeah. Big bag of stuff. And on the bottom, that's a picture of someone's storage building. Actually, it's someone in this church. No, it isn't. but isn't it kind of American that we have buildings so we can store all our stuff that we won't use for years and don't even really know what's in there? It always amazes me in America that we will put a bunch of $12 items we have in a garage and put a $30,000 car out in the driveway. Or more. So, but no, as you get the idea, stuff. Here's the point. How is it idolatry? How is it that coveting after that is idolatry? What makes it idolatry? What's idolatry? Pardon me? Putting anything else before God. We often think it's worshiping a Hindu deity. It's worshiping, Zeus. Or Baal, all of those could be true. But it can be anything. And that's Paul's point. He uses one of the most brutal criticisms for a Jew to describe something as idolatry. Is, you know, that's the worst thing a Jew could call someone. He's an idolater. And he's saying that is true when our heart loves anything more than Christ. Because we go, so really the 10th commandment brings us back to the first. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other God before me. A God is something that you love supremely and trust supremely. And many people trust in their money to deliver them. Many people trust in their stuff and love it supremely. And so covetousness is a heart issue. And see, I think that's the thing that Paul was cut to the quick about. He realized he didn't love the Lord his God. He might have really loved religion. And I've talked to people that I don't think are believers, but they go to these very ornate churches and they'll just talk about how wonderful their church makes them feel. To hear the organ, to smell the incense if they're in the church that uses incense, to hear the prayers, just the ornateness, they feel so spiritual. But that doesn't mean you're having a personal relationship with the Lord. And that's what Paul, I think, cut him to the quick. His religion was an idol instead of a door to the living God. So this is idolatry when all that stuff takes the place of Christ in our heart. And so just a thought on dealing with the sin of covetousness. Again, the New Testament's always talking about putting off and putting on. Some people said it was a picture of, even in baptism, it would be kind of symbolized. You would take off your old clothes and put on a baptismal gown before you went and were baptized. Some of you know what this is like. If you've been working on your car or working in the barn or just working outside in Texas for more than 15 minutes. You come in and your wife or mother says, no, 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 no. You don't come past that spot there. Take those clothes off and put on something less aromatic and something that won't stain my furniture. Put off and put on. That's a picture of the Christian life. Put off sin, put on holiness. And so here's a couple of quotes that speak in terms of putting off covetousness, putting on love for the Lord, contentment. William, does this name look familiar? This author, William Cooper, good friend of John Newton, has written a number of great hymns. The dearest idol I have known, whatever that idol be, here's his prayer, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. That's a good prayer for all of us. What is the idol? I thought about it afterwards. Do you ever do something where right after you finish something, like maybe send an email or a text, then you realize what you should have said? So after I put this PowerPoint together, and I had the guy with the stuff, and there's the money thing, and there's the... I thought what should have been at the center of that heart was a mirror. Because really, the idolatry of covetousness is all about me. And that's where covetousness is, that frothing scum ocean, because I'm angry that God didn't do the things the way I think they should be done. And isn't that what mutiny is? If the lowest sailor on the ship is rebelling against the captain because he doesn't think the captain is handling the storm right or whatever it might be, that's mutiny. And the problem is, do captains of ships ever make mistakes? Many of their ships are on the bottom of the sea. Yeah. Does God ever make a mistake? So why would I trust my judgment, and I fail often, why would I trust my judgment over his? So, William Cooper, the dearest idol I have known, whatever that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. And from Jeremiah Burroughs, listen to what he says. I offer the following description of contentment. Christian contentment is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. Now, how can we freely submit and delight? What's driving that?
Living in the Spirit.
And a fervent trust that God truly is wise, powerful, and good. Are we frustrated with some of our politicians and world leaders? Because they seem to have too much power. But we might question their wisdom. And we're very unconvinced of some of the goodness of some of our leaders at times. And so it's hard for us to be led by such ones. What about God? Is he wise enough to make our decisions? Is he strong enough to bring about his decisions? Are his intentions anything ever but good and loving? Back to Romans 8, right? He who did not spare his own son, what would he hold back? So that's put off discontent, because we all will wrestle with it in our sin-stained hearts, in our unglorified state. We will wrestle with contentment. Make a conscious decision when we hear ourselves murmuring, recognize the mutiny and put it off. Replace it with Scripture. Replace it with trusting in God's goodness, in praising, in honoring, in trusting Him. But it's a conscious decision. And sometimes we have to keep putting off and putting back. Because you know what's the amazing thing? You come in with smelly clothes. You drop them in the garage before you come inside. You got it. These clothes keep sneaking back in from the garage and jumping back on us. And so we've got to consciously choose, put it off and put on. Recognizing that our heart attitude is eminently important to our God. And that's what was stunning to Paul. He thought, if I just look the part, I'm good. And what Jesus kept saying is, do you like the praise of man? Do you like how they applaud you for your great prayers? Enjoy it. That's all you're getting. God's not impressed with your external performance if it doesn't match an internal heart. When Paul got a hold of that, he knew he needed Jesus. And so this drives it home. God speaks to our heart. Any other thoughts or comments on that? Sir? Yeah, so James 4, you know, talks about where's your conflict? And so he's talking about believers having conflict with each other. Is that possible? Is it possible that there might be conflicts within a church? Or a Christian home? Yeah, as long as we have people, you know, that we're going to have conflicts. And so he's saying, where is it coming from? That heart desires. I want. I want it my way. And so then that leads to the conflict of saying, what is God's way? Let's seek the Lord on this. Yeah. So there's the solution. Yeah. So what you need to do is cover your neighbor's humility. And that God gives grace to the humble, resists the proud. And again, what is pride? It's all about me. My way. And so when we have that attitude, God resists us. When you have a heart that's submitting to His way, His will, He gives enablement. Good, good. Yes, Dennis. Isaiah 55:9 is emphasizing God is smarter than us. And we have to embrace that. We have to trust that. And He's not just smart. He's good. He's loving. He's kind. And we have to trust that even though it hurts, He's good. He's loving. He's kind. Reminds me, if I can compare us to our dogs, one time our dog had they were playing, and one dog got the other dog's collar in the mouth so that it was choking the one dog, and the clasp to unhook the collar was inside the other dog's mouth. And so I had to kind of just try to calm that one. They were both very upset. I had to calm the one down and stick my hand into the mouth to get that thing loose. Well, there were a few chomps, but I think it was mostly unintentional. But it was, you know, the whole point was, it was amazing. That dog, in the midst of a very troubling confusion, why is this other dog hanging on my mouth? What's going on here? She actually apparently gave a trust that even though I was sticking my hand into her mouth in a difficult time, she held very still, and I was able to get them released. That's a picture from a dog. Now, it wouldn't be a cat, right? But a dog trusted. In a time of great upset and confusion. And sometimes we'll be, and often I've seen times of great upset confusion, like in a hospital room or in some other context. How important it is. He knows what He's doing. I need to trust Him. Now, does that make it wrong to ask God to change the program, to fix the program, to tell Him the pain, and to ask Him to solve it? No. All those things we can and should do. But so this is not just a, fatalism. Oh, well, God's going to do His will. I'll just sit here and endure it. He wants us to interact. He wants us to pray, but He wants us to trust. A challenging passage. A challenging commandment. Any other thoughts? Yes, sir. Raises a good issue that's probably a whole other lesson or series. Well, the role of, that is a good discussion. I think there is a place for Christian ambition. Work is something that God designed. Sometimes we look at work as part of the curse and the fall. The hardness and fighting against thorns and thistles is the curse. But if you look back, Adam, it says, was working in the garden before the fall. And so work is God's ordained pattern for us. That's how He wants to provide. So ambition is a good thing. Striving to accomplish a goal. But the key is, when it's done for my glory, for self-love, wrong. But, for example, Paul tells, again, there's that passage in Ephesians, remember? Let him who steals steal no longer, but let him instead work with his hands so that he can provide for others. In other words, he is supposed to work so that he not only can provide for himself and his family, but for others. So our ambition should be to be ambitious, to be goal-oriented, to accomplish things, whether it be in terms of, but the key is not letting that become your God. And that could be true in someone trying to accomplish something in their business. It can also be somebody can do that in the church world. I want the church with the biggest billboards. I want the church with whatever it might be. I think you're right. This is not a prohibition of goal-oriented, ambitious labor in any field. But when it's done as a service, and when it's done, what did Paul say? Work heartily unto the Lord. But he did say work heartily. He didn't say sit back, God's sovereign, and just be content. And if God wants you to have something, He'll drop it in your lap. That verse isn't in there. So, good balance. Well, speaking of which, I think I'm noticing my time. We'll look to the Lord in prayer.